You're listening to East of Eden Radio. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Not far from the original Elsie's Barbecue, on a winding curve where Blue Parkway leaves the shaded hillsides of Swope Park and re-enters the forgotten and underserved neighborhoods of East Kansas City, Brooke Salvaggio and her husband Daniel Hare have quietly turned a previously blighted 13.5-acre vacant lot into one of Kansas City's most innovative urban farming experiments. Better known for their beloved farmers market, the Bad Seed, which closed after 9 years in the Crossroads District, Salvaggio and Hare are working full-time now on their farm called Herbivore, which opened in 2011 as an experiment in homesteading in reverse. I met up with busy farmer Brooke to hear how she and her husband, farmer Dan, first acquired the property. Brooke begins by discussing the soil.
So we scoped out the land, you know, pretty intensively before we bought it, and then we took soil samples and all the different kind of geographical, just kind of based on how the land looked and how it laid, we took soil samples in these various areas, and then we kind of planned out the farm accordingly. So orchards are on slopes because you don't want to do vegetable production on a slope where your soil erodes. Do permanent perennials, and our land is largely sloping, so it was great orchard ground, you know. So we have a lot of orchard blocks, then the flatter areas we have vegetable fields, and then we have like specialty perennial blocks like asparagus and strawberries we pass down there. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty diverse. It's
strawberries
a patchwork.
Look great.
Yeah, the strawberries are
awesome.
They
almost look like they're going to have strawberries on them now. They look
really
so robust.
It's good soil down there. We have largely pretty poorly drained clay soil, but the strawberries are in a sweet spot, so they do really well. But yeah, it's a patchwork of foods. I mean,
now
very diverse.
Is this how organic farming is, or is this something that you guys do? You try to craft it around the land?
Push the boundaries of like holistic farming, and we definitely crafted everything we did to this specific property. So yeah, it was every choice was incredibly specific to this piece of land. But just in a more general sense, we grow a huge array of different types of crops, both perennial and annual, and we try to kind of layer them in a way that they benefit one another and just kind of really pump out biodiversity to help us. It just helps us aid in, you know, pest pressure and disease. The more diversity out here and the more sort of plethora of insects, both good and bad, just helps us strike a balance. Mm-hmm. That way we don't have to spray and do all the nasty things we don't want to do.
Soil quality and biodiversity, or lack thereof, is a perennial concern in agriculture. I was interested to learn about the challenges that urban farmers face, especially organic farmers, on the land that was once used for industrial and residential purposes.
I mean, it's one of those things, it's kind of like a blue sky idea, and you really have to put it into practice for many years before you really start to see the benefits of it.
So what was the soil like when you got it?
The soil was largely heavy clay. A lot of our vegetable fields specifically had been excavated. Like this whole field had a house on it long ago. There's foundation in various areas, and it was nasty. So we've done intensive soil building through this sort of no-till kind of permacultural system where we never till the fields, so a tractor blade never goes through them. We just layer heavy straw mulch, compost, and various organic matter on the fields. It kills the sod, and we pull back the straw and we literally plant. And we do this on kind of a large scale, so it's really labor intensive. And then in addition to the no-till and the constant, you know, additives of organic matter, we have about 200 chickens, and they rotate around the farm, and they run on the vegetable plots really, really hard in the off season and fertilize and eat pests and weed and do just all sorts of stuff to build soil.
And produce better eggs. If you think about it, they're not supposed to be vegetarian fed. They're supposed to be eating bugs.
No, they're supposed to be eating. Their natural diet consists of tons of protein in the form of insect protein and then tons of minerals in good organic soil, which the way we farm now depletes the soil. So even if you're running them on pasture, the pastures may totally be depleted of any nutrients. So you have to have a whole, you know, approach to land management that then goes into feeding the chickens this responsible diet. And then you get the kind of yolk that is just so nutritious and can actually like lower cholesterol. You know, free range pastured egg that is, you know, non-GMO can actually lower your cholesterol. So, I mean, people have this total misconception about eggs, you know.
Right. Well, because the eggs are in eating,
eggs
have
in the store
no nutrients.
Are crap. I mean,
yeah. And that's the other thing that I didn't even realize until a few years ago. I'm like, okay, so why are we buying food and then we're buying supplements?
Right. That exactly.
Like, what is that?
You know, we take no supplements just as individuals because our food is providing all of our vitamins and nutrients we could ever need. And if you took like a, you know, if you've like sampled our microbiome or something, or if you like took some, you know, sample of probably what's going on inside of us, we'd probably have like a really awesome, you know, sort of nutrient rich, biodiverse kind of gut thing happening that most people don't have. And
I agree.
It's by eating this way.
I agree
know?
Because I have to say all of the people that I've talked to that are within urban farming or just the farming, natural farming community, nobody has any issue with obesity at all.
Right.
And you know, you step outside
that world, that this very small world of these, you know, holistic eaters and livers. It's an epidemic.
I know it is.
And it's nobody's fault. They've been cheated. Their food system has screwed them. Their government has screwed them. Like, they've fed us poison forever. And it's in not just our food. I mean, it's just like it's everywhere. And that's why I started doing this. I just did not know how otherwise I could eat pure unless I just truly just did it all, you know? And especially on a budget. Like, one thing we've always tried to do is make this food affordable and grow food for the people. I don't want to grow food for bougie rich people. I'm poor. Like, I want food for people like me. I really value the working class. And, you know, I joke that I worked hard to become working class because I grew up in like an upper middle class family and I was really unhappy. You know? So I strive to become working class and just really, I don't know. I want to connect with people.
Not all urban farmers come from the city. But an increasing number of millennial-aged urban farmers are attracted by a lifestyle that offers a sense of purpose and meaning that comes from working close to the land and living a simpler life.
I was just jaded. You know, I looked around and I saw all the green lawns, the SUVs, you know, everything I ate, like, was a microwave meal. Like, I just thought, is this really what life is about? And, you know, my parents wanted me to aspire to the American dream, like everyone else, get rich, you know, provide for your children, have a big house, have a big lawn.
And then be sad and cry alone in the dark.
Exactly. Have a horrible marriage. But, you know, so I was just like, no, this sucks. And, you know, so I just question things a lot. And of course, when you question things, I think at first you rebel, do all the crap you're not supposed to do. And then after I rebelled for years, I started searching for, you know, some more holistic meaning in life. And I started traveling to older parts of the world. And so I went to Peru. That was one place I went was really inspiring. But I started wolfing, which was volunteering my time on organic farms in exchange for room and board.
Oh, yeah.
That's how I paid for my travels.
Okay.
And so I was more in the arts world and, you know, photography and things like that. And so that I was literally using the woofing and the farm work as a means to pay for travel cheaply. But then through working in the dirt and eating this food that these families were growing, it just like opened my eyes and I was like, wow, this is the missing link. So yeah, through traveling and having those experiences, I just like, the minute I got my hands in the dirt, I was like, oh, this is it. This is what I need. After that, I vouched that I would grow all my own food. And then at some point I decided that I wanted to, you know, grow food for others and farm for a living. And then Dan kind of had a different experience. He was always sort of like a community activist and environmentalist. And and this, well, now it's off, but sometimes it's electrified, so just...
Oh, okay. Thanks for telling me.
Because he wanted to kind of live with the migrant workers. He spoke Spanish, so he wanted to improve his Spanish, but he most of all wanted to live and work with the migrants and have, you know, develop an understanding of what that life was like. So it was kind of like more a social type of thing. Through working on this crazy 60-acre orchard, you know, 14-hour days, 7 days a week.
And where was this?
This was in Pennsylvania. So he just fell in love with the farm work and the life and the romance of growing apples and, you know, just all of that. And he was always just a real physical person, a hard worker. So, yeah.
They're very tame. Awesome. Out of all the farms.
These girls, if you come in, like,
they are really
over
tame.
Here, they think we have food. He's pretty.
And that's when our conversation turned to livestock. In this case, ducks, geese, and chickens. You can hear them in the background.
We used to have geese and ducks on the pond. We had about 10 ducks and 4 geese just for eggs for us. And they slowly, one by one, got picked off by a fox. So then the one duck and the one remaining goose, I sort of saved and brought them in with the chickens, because the chickens are always protected from predators with this electrified net. So they've been living in there for like 3 years now. So
they're cool with it?
They're, at first, sometimes there's fights. Like sometimes the chickens gang up on the duck. But the duck is like, actually has talons and sharp teeth, and so he kind of holds his own.
Hard.
And the goose, same
looking.
Thing. Yeah, the goose is mean for sure.
Oh.
But yeah, they're fun. Yeah, the chickens are an essential part of our production. Like we could not do this whole no-till thing without the chickens. It's, you know, they're like half our labor force out here. So, and then the byproduct, of course, is the eggs, which is, you know, a huge draw for our customers, because the eggs are. It's hard to get non-GMO, totally pastured eggs that are, and then they're supplemented with certified organic grain, which is expensive, so a lot of farmers don't do that. But it's necessary if you want to avoid GMOs and pesticides in the food.
Farmer Brooke will discuss how urban farms can produce a much richer diversity of crops than traditional farms. She'll also take us on a tour of the home she and her husband built, completely by hand, from sustainable and reclaimed materials. If you think the hardest thing about living completely off the grid in the heart of the city is building a house and dreaming up ways to produce electricity, potable water, and heat, you'll be surprised that fighting the city for the right to do so can be just as much of a challenge.
We have about acres in vegetable production. We have about 5 in orchards that are not producing yet. And then we have about an acre in specialty crops like blackberries, strawberries, blueberries, asparagus. But once all of our land is producing, like the orchards are in production, I mean, it's going to be a whole heck of a lot of food.
And
you know?
So economically for you guys, how does it work? Are you able to make ends meet?
We
know that.
We can eat well. I tell people, we live like peasants, but we eat like kings and queens. But I never thought like it was insanely viable, and just made it work because we lived really simply. We never took out loans and got ourselves in debt. We just like literally built the farm through our own blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, all the vegetables here have funded the orchard plantings. They funded the construction of our off-grid home. They funded our solar panels. They funded like the fencing, everything on this farm, the vegetables. So it's just a lot of blood and sweat and long hours. So we've made it work through just, you know, pure tenacity. But now I'm realizing it is, in so many ways, compared to other farming enterprises, really viable. I've done a lot of interviews for like different research students and whatnot, and they've also interviewed a ton of conventional farmers who might have like 1,000 acres in production, and like they couldn't believe the income we were pulling in, like telling me about all the other conventional growers that they'd interviewed. You know, either they were surviving off a spouse's supplemental income from their professional job that was not farming, or they were breaking even, you know, barely. But they were not viable endeavors. And the joke is that small-scale organic farming can't feed people and can't sustain the people doing it. And that's just such a joke. We profit largely every year. I mean, even when we have massive crop losses, which for the last 2 years we've lost collectively probably like $80,000 worth of crops due to weather and flooding fields and things. But despite those losses, we profit, and every penny, you know, we don't feel like we profit because every penny goes right back into the land.
Which is the farmer's dilemma.
But that's the farmer. And yeah. We bought raw land, so we had to get water, electricity on here. We had to build a home. We are about to build a barn. We're going to build a greenhouse. So, you know, our plight was massive. It's not like we bought an old farm and rehabbed it. We're starting from scratch, and we're doing all green off-grid infrastructure. So that's just insanely expensive. But, and that's fine. So, you know, so we do profit a lot, but it goes, every penny gets sunk right back into the farm.
Is the off-grid insanely expensive, or is it just that you have to build everything from scratch?
Both. Doing anything well and environmentally responsibly just always costs 10 times more upfront, but there is real savings in it. So, you know, in 20 years, I'll be like, you know, happy as a clam. I mean, we will have, in a year, we will have no utilities, We will just be like totally set out here. We will have all our waters off grid. We have solar power that powers the entire farm. Our home uses no supplemental heating or cooling. We have a composting toilet, grain, black water recycling. Like, we're totally self-sufficient. We have no utility bills out here. And our land payments are really low. Just because of the situation we bought the land in, and it was wrapped up in the city and HUD, and we didn't buy this from an individual.
This was foreclosed.
This was foreclosed on land that was wrapped up in nasty stuff with the city. So we got a 40-year no interest loan.
Wow.
So you know, our land payments are really reasonable, and we're not, you know, accumulating any interest, and it's fine, you know.
The city should give the land to people.
They should have given it to us. I mean, we paid way too much for it.
Actually adding value to the city, the people in the city, the air quality.
Absolutely.
I mean, and you're reclaiming this land.
And we run a citywide composting program too, just of our own. You know, just because we want to. So we sustain the program. We're not getting grant money. It started initially with grant funds, but we basically take food scraps, meat, raw food, dairy, whatever, all food scraps, and yard waste from anybody in the metro area. They can come and drop in our big dumpster in the parking lot, and then we take those food scraps and turn them into, you know, nutrient-rich compost, and that is what goes back on the orchards and vegetable fields. So it's a way, you know, the city's not providing, you know, a municipal composting program, and I feel like it's up to individuals to get that food out of the landfill and where it belongs,
right,
you know.
Right, there you go. Yeah.
So that's a huge service that we provide too.
As we approached the home, we started walking through fields of winter radishes, spinach, kale, and other vegetables.
Most of the fields at this point are out of production because this is like the tail end of the season. This is what's remaining. Like, we just dug your sweet potatoes.
This looks great.
These are winter radishes.
This looks great.
It's a lot of food right here. I mean, it's a small space, but this, like, right here is like, you know, $10,000-$15,000 worth of food. But,
wow.
So there's spinach, there's kale, there's mustard, arugula, tons of winter radish chard. As far as like the winter greenhouse production or hoop house production, like most farms do who do winter production, what we do is really focus on growing a large amount of storage crops in the field, and then this stuff all gets harvested in late November, and then we usually have, you know, a bunch of stuff to sell through December, January, and sometimes, depending on how fast it gets snatched up into February. Mm-hmm. But like this
year, it's probably good to take a break, like have a little month off.
We've been building a house for three consecutive winters. Like our winters are consumed with infrastructure projects that are like even, you know, harder than farming. So we can't be like messing with hoop houses and greenhouse production for microgreens or some, you know, like that. Like, we're interested in doing, you know, to manage a farm. I mean, the off season allows you to, even if you're not building infrastructure, it allows you to mend fencing and clear areas and you know, do all these things that you just don't have a chance to do during the on season. So winters are really valuable. But we try to grow, I mean, this winter we'll have tons of sweet potatoes all winter long. Great. We'll have tons of radishes, watermelon radishes, black Spanish radishes. We'll have some turnips, and we'll have onions and garlic. We'll have eggs, of course, and then we may have some random other offerings depending on how the weather behaves, but should have some good, you know, calories for people in the off season. So yeah, it's nice. And then eventually we'll have apples. We have a lot of apple varieties that store for a long time, so hopefully we'll have those to sell in the winter.
Finally, we made it to the far end of the property and the homestead that Brooke and Dan had been working on the previous three winters. The house is very small, but once complete, they'll be able to produce enough electricity, heat, and potable water for the entire farm. As we walked, Brooke explained the reasons why so many urban farms are moving into socially and economically disadvantaged parts of major metropolitan areas.
You have to do this in more depleted working class areas, like, or you can't get away with urban farming in middle class neighborhoods. I tried. You can't.
And what do you mean by get away with?
No, it's sad. Like, I used to have a small farm in South KC. It was on a 2.5-acre lot. That's where I got my start. It was just me, and I did veggies, and I had chickens and goats, and I had this little homestead. Kind of watch this stuff here. But that was in South Kansas City. And my neighbors, and the gardens were beautiful. I mean, it was smaller, so I could really keep everything up. It was very maintained. And the neighbors felt that these were kind of bougie white people, and they felt that the presence of a farm would bring down their property value. So they waged a war on us, and they had a lot of political connections within the city, city council people on their side, and it spawned this huge ordeal. And all in all, we were kind of kicked off the property, but it did spawn an urban ag ordinance that is designed to protect urban farmers now, and it actually like sort of paved. I mean, nobody in the city knew what urban ag was before that incident. The whole Bad Seed Farm incident kind of put urban farming on the map.
Is that where you got your name?
Yeah, so my first farm was Bad Seed Farm. And, you know, then there's Bad Seed.
Because you're bad.
Because yeah, I'm bad, for sure. So, yeah, so this is the house. So it's, you didn't see the pond, but the pond is down there. There's a quarter acre pond. And so.
So how far back does it go then?
So this property goes to the tree. We have about a few feet in, well, I'd say about 10 feet into that tree line there. Yeah, so it's kind of long, narrow property. So the house is, it's basically, you know, it's built largely of concrete.
And this is the house?
Yeah, this is okay. The house. It's an earth berm passive solar home. And so you've got earth coming up the north wall. It goes right up onto the roof. There's about a foot of soil on the roof. And then you have earth that comes up 6 feet on this side.
You guys are going to be just like your vegetables.
Oh, it's like, it's our hobbit house. Yeah, we're just, it was designed to be like set in the belly of the earth. But at the same time, we're at the highest point of the property. So we can see the sun rise and set, and that's why the east and west walls are completely
cool.
Glass. And then from the roof, you can even see like downtown.
Oh,
you can
wow.
See the plaza lights and stuff. It's wild, but it's a small house. It's totally, you know, energy efficient. No supplemental heat.
Oh, wow.
So,
look at this.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. And the view is just.
It feels good in here, too.
Yeah, it feels really good in here. And yeah, it's got. Well, all of it's all like non-toxic materials, tons of reclaimed stuff. My husband's done like everything. He had no building skills before this. But so the way it works is kind of, you know, you've got these clear story windows on the south wall, and you've got earth up to where the windows start. So this gives you that greenhouse effect. So this warms the house. Or when it's hot out, it does the opposite. You know, it stays extremely cool in here. Amazing. It just, you know, the way the house works, the way it's designed is meant to work, you know, for what people need. Just sort of an element we've lost in modern day design. Then there'll be a composting toilet that handles all solid waste. The water system's pretty cool. We take water from the pond, and then it moves through this totally non-toxic, chemical-free filtration system that was specially designed for us, and it was a pain in the butt because it had to meet city code. So this is like a serious engineering project. And it's totally specific to this house. And so it moves through this massive sand filter, then goes through UV filtration, then the water gets, you know, piped into the house, you use it, then all gray water, black water, so meaning like even urine, on the back end runs through this specially designed green septic system that was also specially engineered for this project. And it uses no chemicals, nothing. It's largely sand and gravel and UV. And then that water gets purified to the point where it's technically potable again. But we won't drink it. We're going to reuse it for farm needs, like watering all the seedlings in the greenhouse, watering the chickens and the livestock and all that stuff. So everything is kind of full circle and gets reused. And then we have a big 10K solar system that powers. The house uses like next to no energy, but the solar panels, well, you can see them from here, they largely power what will be the barn that will house the walk-in coolers.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So, and we can go up there and get a better view.
Yeah, because you do need a cooler.
Yeah, so we'll have two walk-in coolers, one for veggies, one for fruit, and solar panels should power that. We're hoping to add on to them eventually, but it was Casey only approved so big of a system, and they've been so annoying to work with. I'm gonna shut this door, but we can walk out.
So now where are the bedrooms then?
So we don't have the interior walls built right now, but the way the house works, because I forget, like I know what's going on in here, but it's totally confusing if you have no idea. So basically, this is the hearth floor. So the wood-burning stove sits here. It's a wood-burning cook stove. So that can also be used for heat in the house if needed. And then like the kitchen sink is here. So we have this big cabinet that's gonna be built. Sinks here,
And then you've got like these long countertops that run the length of this wall and that wall. The idea was that this side was sort of the day living because you see the sunrise, and mm-hmm. that side's the night living because you see the sunset. So both of these areas like can stand out into one massive kitchen if I need it to. We have like swing out workstations that come out, and I do big canning projects and things like that. So it, you know, you have to be creative in a space this small. So it's very functional. And then that's the bathroom. And then what happens is it's kind of the same on both sides, but there's a wall that will kind of run diagonally from about there to here, and then it leaves an opening. And so that's one bedroom, that's our bedroom. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, you know, divides these two rooms. And then same thing happens over here, this diagonal wall that divides up the spaces, and that's my son's bedroom. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it works. It's larger than our current rental house, so.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
No, I haven't been there, but.
Yeah, but it works. You know, we're used to living in small spaces, but yeah, I mean, it's cool. The hearth floor is, it's all reclaimed. Well, those were like 200-year-old bricks on Chicago streets at one point. They've been cut thin, and we reclaimed them. So that's what makes the hearth floor. And then that is reclaimed roofing slate on the bathroom floor. And then these, the yellow bricks, are from like old Milwaukee factory buildings. And then the crazy drywall is actually just trash. It's all trash. Like, soy milk containers and, you know, that nasty material that's neither plastic, I don't know even what it is, but basically the adhesive in that material, which you cannot recycle, there's an adhesive in the material that this company just like literally shreds it and then like presses it together, and so it's pure trash, you know? And once it's done, then hopefully we can like try to get some attention for it in terms of, we're trying to pave the way for green building here.
I recorded my original conversation with Brooke a few years ago, and recently caught up with Brooke and Farmer Dan at a local Salvadoran restaurant. Their two boys were restless and hungry like two wild pups. Brooke told me that farmers don't eat out much, but on this afternoon I imagined it a welcome reprieve. Between the never-ending work on the farm and raising their two rambunctious kids, I could tell they were bushed. I always marvel at how Brooke and Farmer Dan live such authentic lives. Though not easy or financially lucrative ones, they are spoiled in a way. Each day arrives with a purpose and focus on the work at hand, work done with their bodies, and they raise their children free range like the chickens, with the farm as their preschool. They can literally taste the fruits of their labor and see their work blossom and bloom, and through it help the people of Kansas City eat healthier and make the city more environmentally balanced. You can visit Brooke and Farmer Dan every Saturday this summer and into early fall at the Brookside Farmers Market, the only 100% organic market in Kansas City. If you want to get more involved with Herbivore Farm, there are opportunities to volunteer and work at the farmstead. Brooke also publishes a wicked good blog about her beautiful and unconventional life on her website, herbivorefarm.com. East of Eden Radio is written, edited, and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Theme music by Letterbox. We have more stories to tell, from ancient caves to punk rock coming of age to long forgotten utopias. All stories from right here where we live in the heartland. Until then, keep it tuned right here to 90.1 FM KKFI on the west side of the dial and east of Eden.